Good morning and welcome to Pathways. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Every Sunday morning at this time, we invite you to join us for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. A counselor who was a guest on Pathways once said, "Good relationships are not about the avoidance of conflict. The two most important ingredients for successful relating are adaptability and conflict resolution." Today, our guest on Pathways is a cutting-edge figure in the area of conflict resolution, author Deidre Combs. Today, we're going to discuss her new book entitled The Way of Conflict. A credentialed mediator and facilitator, Dr. Deidre Combs is the founder of Combs & Company, a consulting firm that provides conflict skills training, coaching, and strategic planning. She is a faculty member of the University of Creation Spirituality and also of Naropa University, as well as an interfaith minister. Combs & Company's diverse clients include many corporate, nonprofit, and educational organizations, including IBM, the Landmine Survivors Network, and the U.S. Forest Service. Deidre holds a BA in mathematics and Spanish from the University of Wisconsin, a master's from George Washington University, and a doctorate of ministry from the University of Creation Spirituality. Deidre was employed for over 15 years by the corporate sector in project management and marketing leadership. She lives in Bozeman, Montana, with her husband and three children. Good morning, Deidre, and welcome to Pathways.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
How is your philosophy of confronting conflict different from a lot of the other books and services out there?
Oh. Well, you know, about 10 years ago, I went looking for what does everybody say about conflict. I went to the spiritual traditions around the world, indigenous traditions, mystical traditions, as well as the new tradition of quantum physics, and added some mediation theory on top of that, and looked for common themes. And I was richly rewarded. So much of what I found was similar across all these traditions.
So you found common themes. Did you find any conflict between the different traditions' treatment of conflict?
Well, that's a great question. You know, a lot of it lies in language. For example, I relied heavily on the Art of War and the Gita from the Hindu tradition, for example. They use a lot of words around battle, but you start to look underneath those, and you can find common themes about detachment, for example, the ability to be flexible in conflict. So it's fascinating to me. Once I would look for what was the essence of what was being said, I was very, very similar.
Now, it's been said that the human species is a warlike one. What is your take? Having looked at the history of conflict, would you agree with that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We do have a reptilian brain as one of our four brains that reside in our head, and that is very focused on survival. When we go to that brain, we go to fight flight, and there we engage in war and violence. And it's also a place where we say, I'm starving, and I need food, and I must destroy in order to get food. So it is something that is innate within us, and yet we have three other great brains there that can drive the show as well. It doesn't always need to be a fight-flight experience. The neocortex, for example, the two hemispheres that sit on the top of our head are a place of great problem solving. They can engage in past, present, and future, where the reptilian brain, for example, can only deal with the present.
The reptilian brain is pretty quick, though, right? I mean, people react before they think. What is the interplay between the reptilian brain and the neocortex in a situation that most people might find alarming?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's wonderful. I've started to realize that no matter what, when we're in conflict, we'll go initially to our reptilian brain. We'll be sent there to say, okay, is this an issue of survival? It's quick. A child's about to cross the street. We grab them. We're not really worried about long-term effects, relationship issues. We're just trying to keep that child safe. However, what I found is that the neocortex, for example, is the next place that we can go. And what's fascinating to me is that the spiritual traditions give us all these different practices, prayer, meditation, counting our blessings, for example. They seem like they're things that are nice to have, but literally they will take you from your reptilian brain into your neocortex and also connect you to your prefrontal lobes, which are at the front of your head, where empathy and compassion and this connection to the greater community resides.
In all of the research that you did, and obviously it's a pretty comprehensive book, The Way of Conflict. And out of all of this research, what was one of the most surprising discoveries you made?
Well, there was really two that I would like to share with you. One was that conflict, it appears that we're, it's like a mess that we're in the middle of, but really it's actually a four-staged process, a four-quartered game of sorts. In economics, they use the words game and conflict interchangeably. If we can get to the end of the conflict, to the fourth quarter, there always resides a win-win solution. That, to me, was very exciting. All the traditions promise that to us. They talk about a place of unity where you can be right and I can be right. We can both be taken whole. And then the other discovery I found is I used to think that if I was in conflict with you, I had to bring you along with me. So if for us to find a solution, and say I'm trying to find a solution for a large community, oh my gosh, I had to drag everybody with me. It's not the case. If just I can understand what you need to be made whole and what I need, I can figure out the solution and then and I can propose it and you're going to like it because it's something that's going to work for you as well. That was very empowering.
You know, I find it fascinating, this whole concept of the four stages of conflict resolution that you outline in your book, The Way of Conflict. Can you go through them for us?
Sure. So think of it as though everything's going along fine. You know, you as a system are stable, or our relationship is stable, and something comes in to disrupt it. So the first phase is disruption, change, essentially. Through the cultural traditions, we're really asked here to gather as much information as possible. It is the time where we're supposed to survey our opponents and the battlefield. Because inevitably we're going to dive right into the second phase when conflict intensifies and we'll have some degree of chaos. The system's trying to reorganize itself with this new information. And if we can make it through here, and that's real tough often, depending on how complex or how emotional the conflict is, we'll move to the third phase, which is evolution, creativity. And here, if we can open ourselves and listen, we'll find all sorts of amazing solutions. We'll move from those two initial positions we had in the first phase, for example, to 10, 100 solutions. Now, to get back to stability, which is the fourth phase, we need to test out those creative solutions and to implement one. So that takes us back to stability, to the fourth phase, and it goes around again and again and again. Depending on how complex the conflict, we may loop around, spiral around multiple times.
Are there, in phase three, the creativity phase, what can you elaborate a little bit on the relationship between creative solutions and listening?
Yes. Well, you know, each of these phases, I found, have an elemental principle. And then in the third phase, the elemental principle is to listen. It's to really engage in the walk of the mystic, to stop and look, and which is also often to look within, and to listen. So it is a critical piece. And it's to the sense of the second phase, the chaos phase, is a place of just wearing us down a bit, opening us, removing some of our filters so we can see the solution that really is already there waiting for us.
Now, how do people get short-circuited when they're in the chaos phase? It seemed to me that that's when that reptilian brain can take over and people can go into reaction or get stuck and some get more deeply stuck in a position.
Yeah. The second phase of chaos, we're each of those phases, we're struggling. There's a challenge that comes with them. You know, every blessing has its curse. So you're in the second phase of conflict, and chaos really often sends us to a place of hopelessness, victimization. What's the use? Why try? And as we move into that, we'll either run or say, I give up, and start fighting. But what we're counseled to do here is to relax. And the elemental principle here is to detach. Detachment does not mean not caring. It means to let things be as they are and see what you can let go of so that new ideas can come forward.
Now, do you see any gender differences in the way that people handle conflict? Like, do males have a larger reptilian brain, or do are there any? I mean, there are certainly differences in hormone levels. I read somewhere that males have 7 times as much testosterone as females on average. What have you noticed?
Well, you know what I've noticed is interesting in terms of male-female is that there's new research saying that women, when they are pushed into a corner, will go to relate. They'll try to create community as quickly as possible. So as I describe this philosophy, it's often a philosophy that's very welcome in the community of women. But
probably more needed in the community of
potentially, yeah. You know, we also rely on our men to keep us safe. So who knows, is that a biological thing or a cultural thing? But, you know, in a relationship, we often say, okay, the man is going to make sure that that our house is safe and that the children are kept safe and that we have enough food. And so I wonder, you know, I think there's all this important brain research being done that shows how these 4 brains interact. And I do wonder if it's cultural or biological, is that we ask our men to move into the reptilian brain, make sure that we're safe, and the women, meanwhile, are making sure that their relationships are all intact.
You know, you said every blessing has its curse. It sort of occurs to me that your book is based on the premise that every curse has its blessing, because there's such a positive spin put on conflict. I mean, here we are at war in Iraq, there's violence in the streets. You know, conflict to most people means pain, injury, death. You know, how is it that you can get away with calling conflict a potential gift?
Well, you know, it's funny because sometimes it does sound a bit Pollyanna-ish or idealistic. But I can't think of a time when I haven't grown without some challenge. When I am stable and all is going along well, I am not going to change. And without that constant push for growth and evolution, I become weaker. I become stagnant. So I know that conflict's the best thing I've got going for me in terms of my overall development. And yet it does. It can carry pain. It carries risk because often we don't understand how to act in conflict and can get ourselves into a place where we, you know, move to the reptilian brain and we move to a place of violence and destruction. So yeah, it's not the most fun thing to engage in, but it's the best thing I've got going for me to become a better person.
Are there any people for whom it's fun? I mean, like extreme athletes or top flight athletes that are super competitive, is it fun for them?
Well, that's a beautiful example because really they are trained warriors. I mean, they're being asked to go to their edge because that's where we grow. Their coaches will create stress, i.e. conflict, for them so that they can become better at what they do. And it's interesting. I like to talk to people who've had good football coaches, for example, and they really understand this walk of the warrior. The first phase of conflict, for example, each of them have their own vocation, each of the 4 phases. The first phase is this walk of the warrior. And I talk to, like I said, ex-football players, and they'll talk about what it means, the discipline that we need to engage in when we're in conflict, and the code of conduct that we need. And that's what the warriors of old and the martial artists understand, is that there's a code of conduct in conflict where we don't engage in destruction, and then we recognize that our opponent is our best teacher.
Now, it's obvious that there's a need in the world for conflict resolution skills, but what drew you in particular to this area of specialty?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was raised in a family of 4 girls, so we fought all the time. And they are 3 of the dearest people in my life. So I've always had some kind of connection to those who will fight with you and stick with you, that they give you a great gift. But about 10 years ago, I got started on all this because I was facilitating very contentious meetings for IBM. And people were walking out, customers were furious, and I thought, oh, geez, I'm going to lose my job. And for the lack of anything better, I sat down and started asking all the questions that I knew these customers, who I really loved, were wanted to ask but wouldn't ask. And the meeting changed. And then I parroted back what I heard in a language that I knew the customers would understand, and the meeting changed even more. And at the end, everyone was applauding me for what a great job I had done. I didn't know exactly what I had done, but I wanted to know more. And that's what sent me. And I realized I didn't need to necessarily be a victim of conflict, run away, that there it was a game, and that there was ways to play. And not to be stupid about it. I mean, I know my opponents can hurt me. But to that, in the martial artist, there's the opening bow that says, "You are a great teacher. You have much to show me. I am watching you carefully. Please, let's begin."
You know, the goal and what you say is validated in all the traditions is to come to a win-win resolution. And yet, it seems to me that in any conflicted situation, the resolution is going to be pretty unique.
Yes.
And it's going to involve, like you say, stage three, creativity.
Exactly.
What part does faith play in that? Because you talk about the unknown and being willing to be with the unknown.
Yes.
But that takes a certain kind of faith. Can you describe that faith?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's if you look at the second and the third phase of conflict, chaos and creativity or evolution, those are very much connected with the invisible, what isn't known, what isn't seen. In our culture, those have always been something that for a long time ignored, and in other times we try to run away from them as best we can. And yet, if we are able to be in chaos and in that place of not knowing and have faith that we live in a world of extraordinary possibilities, amazing things happen. I've seen it at the mediation table again and again, where two people come in and they are diametrically opposed in their initial positions. And inevitably, they'll move to a place of silence. And if I can let them sit there and they'll stay there, new ideas will come forward that I didn't even know could possibly exist. So it's the sense of faith in the invisible. The traditions from the East understand this. They see, they're very in line. For example, the Buddhism and Taoism are very, very in line with quantum physics that sees what is known as a real tiny part of what is.
So you hold to the belief in any situation that there is a possible win-win, even though you might not know what it is going in and going through the process.
Yeah, that's what gives me hope.
So there's kind of an improvisational aspect to conflict resolution.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Art of War, as I said, it's a 3,000-year-old Taoist text on conflict, talks about solutions that have a lot of shir, which is S-H-I-H, and they are elegant solutions. And they explain that you can never, that a formula cannot be applied, that in the moment. And the great warrior knows this, that in the moment there's going to be a solution that is simple and elegant. It's like when you're playing chess and there's that absolute perfect move, but that move will never be seen again. So it's being open to that elegant solution.
So after all this work that you've done in this area of conflict resolution, do you have less conflict in your life now?
No, I wouldn't want it. Actually, it's funny because what I started to realize is that life brings conflict. I mean, what's fascinating is in the beginning microseconds of the universe, the new cosmologists tell us, a great disequilibrium occurred, difference, conflict occurred. And that is what allows this universe to continue to expand and evolve. Things that are different come together, push on one another, and in their pushing, they learn about each other, and they grow and expand, and the universe gets bigger, and we get bigger. So I think what's happened for me is that the paradigm has changed. I'm not always thrilled when a battle appears before me, either internally or externally, but I do know it's the best thing I've got going for myself, and I do. I look to those skills that I've found from the traditions around the world.
Pretty soon you're going to start causing conflicts just for the personal growth potential.
I don't know.
you have so many ideas and exercises in your book, The Way of Conflict. Tell us, in the heat of battle, what is it that you try to remember?
Well, you know, I try to always back up to my four, I call them the four transforming gifts you can give somebody, because they do transform any conflict when they're used skillfully. The first thing I try to do is to ask as many open-ended questions as possible. It buys me time, it lets me know more about the landscape that I'm playing in, and it also respects my opponent. I try to laugh at myself. Humility is an incredible transforming gift in conflict that you can give others. Gandhi always said, if I couldn't laugh at myself, I would have committed suicide a long time ago. It creates sanity. Next, I try to acknowledge as many of the positions as possible. I don't have to agree with them. Acknowledgement is saying, I see you, I hear you, and I'm also incorporating your ideas into my own. And then last, to be honest, to try as best I can to come from a place of I in that. If I'm saying you are a, I'm probably not being honest. But if I can talk about I feel offended, I'm scared, whatever it is, it's a transforming gift.
I've heard it said that there's always more than two solutions to any problem. And yet we tend to think in terms of black and white. Right. What has been your observation?
Well, you know, the great thing is, if you look at Taoism, for example, it says that we play in a field of polarity. So there's a unified field, but there's polarities. There's difference. And when we begin in conflict, inevitably it will feel black, white, up, down. You owe me $100. I don't think I owe you anything. Those are our initial positions. We get to see the polarities. But if we can stick together long enough without seeking to destroy each other or running away, what you'll find underneath is what those wants and needs that are hidden under those perceived opposites. And in that, we get a bigger view of reality.
Now, you say that conflict is a spiritual discipline, and we've been talking around that, but can you define what you mean by that?
Well, you know, as I started to look at conflict being a fundamental element of our world, if we're alive, we have conflict in some form. We have conflict with gravity every day, for example. I started to realize that in challenge, it's the ability to practice these spiritual disciplines, these spiritual practices, and it just becomes, conflict becomes a discipline, a way for us to work through the world as it is, this field of polarities, and to find a bigger, more expanded view. You know, different traditions would call that enlightenment, for example. But that's what conflict gives us, the possibility of better understanding our relationship, better understanding what motherhood means, parenthood means, better understanding what religious tolerance means, or religion means, for that.
You mentioned motherhood, and you're the mother of three. I wonder how much of a platform for learning about conflict that's been for you.
Yeah, that's a great battleground, let me tell you. Because everybody's trying to change and grow in my house. I now have two teenagers, and it's this amazing process of watching them, in a way, die to who they were as children so that they can come back in this new form. Again, that evolution is occurring. Oh, every day in my house. So it's a good practice point, and they've been great teachers. I think that is what the practice of parenting is how to be in conflict and stay together and look for ways that we can all emerge whole. It's not always easy.
You speak in your book, The Way of Conflict, about sticking together until a conflict is complete. Are you saying that one should stay in a marriage even if it's bad? Are you suggesting that we shouldn't fire employees or leave organizations?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it often looks like that. If I say, you know, you need to stick with this, people immediately look at the current form, the way things are today, and they say, okay, you're telling me I have to stay with my marriage, for example. And really what I'm saying is stay with the conflict that's before you. Stay with the conflict around your relationship and see what new form needs to come forward. If you get stuck in your initial position that this marriage must be destroyed or this marriage must be saved, we're doing the same thing as saying, you owe me $500 and I owe you nothing. We need to get below those initial positions to find that place where everyone can be taken whole.
Now, I've noticed a lot in my own experience and in my own observation that a lot of people seem to have a very strong need for what they call closure.
Mm-hmm.
They want things resolved and often will just go to a position, a black and white position, in order to get that kind of clarity for themselves, even if the position is not necessarily for their highest good or for the highest good of the relationship. Can you speak to that?
Well, that's, you know, it's great because really what you're describing is what happens when we get stuck. We go into a place of positionality and we say, this is the only way it can be, and I'm right, you're wrong. And if I'm going to, I'm right, you're wrong, I am stuck in a phase of conflict. And I'm going to be there a while until I start to recognize that the view on the world that you see can be just as valuable as the one that I see, even if it appears to be crazy. Doesn't mean that I have to give up my view of reality, but to look beyond and say, okay, how can we both be right? It's not always easy. And you're right, we all want stability. All the systems in the universe seek homeostasis or stability. So it's amazing. We have a conflict around conflict. The world is built on disequilibrium, difference, to create expansion and evolution, and every system in the universe wants peace.
That is a kind of a built-in irony,
yep,
isn't it?
Yep.
Why don't you tell us about your website and the role that it plays in your work?
Okay. Well, so you can go to my website, which is www.wayofconflict.com. There you can learn about the book, and that is getting expanded. We're adding a place for case studies and newsletters, so do come back. We're hoping to be able to provide some online assistance with conflicts as well.
And aside from being the author of the book, obviously you've got mm-hmm. a practice. Can you describe what kind of clients and services happen?
Okay, you know, I do mediation in a corporate environment as well as in personal disputes. I do facilitated dialogues for teams that are trying to evolve and learn new things or develop new products. And then I do individual coaching for people that are trying to become better working in contentious situations, either in their personal relationships or as well as managers or business owners.
Mm-hmm. And as a final thought, we're just about running out of time here. As a final thought, considering the fact that everybody listening has to deal with conflict and challenges in their life, is there any parting words of advice that you would like to leave our audience with today?
Well, you know, I always try to remember two things, is that conflict, no matter how well you play, it's still going to be messy. We are birthing new ideas, new solutions, and often a new us. And in my experience as a mother of three, birth is usually a pretty messy process. So my second piece of advice is to be gentle with yourself. The evolutionary process of conflict is tough to thwart. It will continue to move on and recognize that we're all in this together, and it's worth playing.
And that there is a creative solution.
There is.
What did somebody once said? That there's a simple solution to every complicated problem, and it's usually wrong.
No.
But that's not what we're talking about here.
Right.
We're not talking about simple solutions. We're talking about dynamic, evolving solutions.
Yes.
And I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Deidre. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Having you on Pathways and
thank
talking
you.
About your work and your new book, The Way of Conflict by Dr. Deidre Combs. Available at all the finer bookstores in the Portland area, including New Renaissance. And we're really glad to have had a chance to talk about it today.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
And I want to thank our audience for tuning in to Pathways today, and hopefully every Sunday at this time, when either Tom Park or myself invite you to join us for a visit with selected leaders in personal and cultural transformation. On behalf of KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, and the Pathways program, this is Paul O'Brien signing off.